Howdy, Haunts. This is Keats Ross, host of Prag Magic. Just wanted to take this time to introduce you to my new audiomancy, well, and videomancy project, a song sigil series. Basically, I'm cycling through the song sigils that make up the major hyper sigil of my first Revel Roz release. You can find it at revelroz.bandcamp.com. That's R-E-V-E-L, short for Revelator, and R-O-S-Z, which I'm told is Hungarian for evil. Fancy that. Anyways, it will be in the show notes. Stick around to the end after my wonderful chat with the death doula and modern psychopomp Brie Rose, and you can hear it in full. As always, you can become a patron for as little as $1 a month and help support all the media magics and art barfs that I am wont to do. Patreon.com/pragmagic. There's a lot of fun stuff down the pipeline. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for subscribing, liking, commenting, any kind of engagement. It's been a long journey, almost 100 episodes, and I feel like I'm just getting started. Without further ado, here's my wonderful chat with the brilliant Brie Rose. Haunt on. Howdy, howdy. Hello. I am Keats Ross. This is Prag Magic. I'm here with Brie Rose. Hello, Brie.
Hi.
I'm very excited to have you on. Just a quick, you know, maybe a little blurb about Brie. She is an end-of-life doula, a transition guide. She utilizes skills in ritual, sound healing, education, advocacy, all of that to assist the leaving and the bereaving. Through the mysteries of the great inevitable that awaits us all. She's a modern psychopomp of sorts, part of Seattle's Stone Circles Collective. And their mission really is to support individuals in maintaining their autonomy, sovereignty, individuality through death and the process thereof. So thank you so much, Brie, for joining me. I know that we just found out that you're a neighbor, and I'm kind of bummed because I would have loved to have done this in person rather than, you know, the pesky internet stuff. But now we know.
Next time.
Yeah. But yeah, it's so good to have you. As we were talking about earlier as well, at the local coffee shop, I go through a routine sometimes where I'll be working there and I'll peruse the, you know, the cork board and saw the Stone Circles stuff. And I've always had a deep, you know, interest outside of just like the metaphysical or philosophical stuff when it comes to the process of death, but more so in the, I don't know, the service of it too. And your card jumped out at me and now here we are. And so it's great to meet you. And I'm really excited to learn more about all that you guys do and you do specifically.
Yeah. I'm so glad you reached out.
Yeah, no, it's kismet. Funny enough, this was scheduled for maybe a couple weeks, but I just lost somebody a couple days ago, actually. So, you know, one of the funny kind of synchronous things is, oh, I've already scheduled my, you know, death doula appointment ahead of time. So,
yeah. Well, I'm sorry that happened. It's never easy, regardless of the circumstances.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the tether, like throughout, even though like every death is individualistic, you know, we all share this kind of inevitability of it. Mm-hmm. And you know, under researching you a bit and understanding kind of your like sect of it, I've always been interested as to like what was the spark that made you kind of elect this path working? Because you do have a like a psychology background, is that correct?
I do. There's a several different paths that kind of led me on this main path. And a big part of it was my study in psychology. When I was doing my senior seminar project, I was given the assignment of the subject of making meaning, and I could do with that what I chose. And I decided to do my project on making meaning in death and funerary rituals because I found that very fascinating. I've always been a morbid creature and interested in death and dying and all of everything related. And in doing my studying and research, it became so clear that most of society in the U.S. is lacking so fiercely in rituals around death and dying, whereas so many other cultures and places around the world are really intimate with death. And the psychology connection with that is that psychological grief processing is so much... What is the term? It gets so much more powerful and easy to process your grief when you have that option to be hands-on. But we have been taught through years of capitalistic patriarchy and misinformation that we should not handle the dead, that once somebody dies, they're dirty, they need to be removed completely and in the hands of a professional who knows what they're doing. And then we can have an appointment in the sterile place to see our dead person if we want to, even if it's as portrayed to be scary and unclean and all of these things. And it's really unfortunate and really unhelpful to the grief process. So that was really striking to me when I did that project. And around the same time, I saw a documentary about home funerals, and I found that very fascinating. It was also around the time that my daughter was very small, and I worked at an alternative baby clothing shop in Seattle called Bootyland. That's just like organic punk rock tees and cloth diapering, and all of these things, and really like punk rock natural parenting. Yeah. And there is a movement with that of taking it back into your hands and taking back that sovereignty of like home birth and not doing it on a doctor's time and creating a birth plan. And so seeing that other end of the spectrum of creating a death plan and taking that sovereignty back and not letting some professional guy in a suit tell you how you should honor the most important transitions of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. It must be really hard to shake that tabooification that is like so ingrained in Western culture that, you know, it's hushed. It's something we all experience. It's something that we all will experience. And yet we're not really allowed to, you know, speak or celebrate it about it much, mm-hmm. at least in, you know, this side of the world. But I find it interesting that that confluence of the DIY kind of punk ethos of, you know, a big thing for me is that background as well. And it's like, yeah, if you want to live a customized life, you have to consider the customized ritualization and, you know, individuation process of death itself. Mm-hmm. And so once you kind of found that, is there like a credentialing program? Like what are your steps after you kind of are moved by something like that to see it, you know?
Yeah. Happen? So it was not too long after that I started seeing that there were trainings for end of life doula. I had never heard of that before. And it really felt like something that I wanted to do. And I already knew that I could be around really emotional, heavy situations without having it affect me so strongly that I wasn't able to move through it and that I could hold space for others in those type of scenarios. So I started taking trainings. There are so many more out there at this point. I do trainings as well. There are a lot of certifications. I have my own feelings around certifications for death doula work. It's not required to have a certification or specific credentials. It's very unregulated at this point. Mm-hmm. Ethically, it's important if you're doing this work to understand the laws, understand the legal boundaries between death doula and funeral director. But I've heard it said a lot, and I agree that if we're really doing our job right, we're going to put ourselves out of work, because what we're doing is we're supporting and teaching families and communities to tend to their own dead. And yeah. It's something that was taken away from us by the capitalistic patriarchy, like thinking that bodies have to be embalmed, bodies have to be taken care of by a professional. So in re-educating families and communities that you don't need to be a professional, that this is an ancestral skill, the idea that you have to have a certification to be a death doula is a step backwards, in my opinion. And we're teaching people that you have to be certified in order to tend to your dead, which is what we're trying to stray away from.
I love that. Yeah. And it keeps, you know, kind of barking to me about this idea of like the funeral industrial complex, right? Mm-hmm. Because it is such a heavy moated machine already. Mm-hmm. And it really feels like we are dealing with not only like the health institutions that kind of deal maybe with palliative care, but also after that you go into, you know, yeah, funeral home. It's either renting, you know, a gravesite. It's, you get two options. Are you buried? Are you cremated? You know, so it does seem like this well-oiled kind of corporate machine for the afterlife, or the transition, I should say. And so like when you're starting out, you're basically, I like that there doesn't need to be a kind of standardization or like a credential of sorts for it. But what are some of the kind of, I don't know, like the kind of learning processes that you went through that you think really kind of helped you set, that you would share maybe folks would really benefit from, that's not necessarily, you know, part of that funeral industrial complex, doesn't need to be credentialed? Were there like teachings, were there, you know, workshops? Like, how did you like really start to break into it?
So my initial training was through a company called Enelda, and I didn't learn a whole lot that I didn't already know through my psychology training, because they teach a lot about active listening and being supportive, meeting the client where they're at, which is really important to not just force your own agenda into what you think somebody should do, but rather educate them about options and listen to what their needs are and kind of navigate how you can support that. Over the pandemic, I was taking so many trainings online. At that point, I had already established myself as a doula, but you never stop learning. I'm trying to think of what specifically were the things that stuck out to me.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Okay.
I was just going to say that, like, it seems to me that there is kind of it's more vexed in like personality and experiential kind of credential, you know?
Yeah. Most of what I've learned has come through experience. And I was really curious about a lot of things. I really pursued any education that I could, that I wasn't getting. I wanted to know about all of the details and logistics around keeping a body at home, how to be a home funeral guide, what all that entailed, how you can be an owner, organ donor and get an autopsy and all of those things, yet still bring the body home if you wanted to, and how to do wound care around that. And any sort of logistic, any question that I had, I pursued the answers to, because I like to be fully informed of all the things before I meet with a client and meet with a family. And I do many mentorship programs as well. So people will from all over will book an hour with me and ask, how do I start this path? What do I do? And I help them explore how to get started, or maybe what their specific skills are, because there is a very large spectrum of what you can do as an end-of-life doula. And I had a point. What was my point? Oh, one of the things that I always tell them is that when you walk this path, when you are actively having these conversations with people, maybe going to death cafes or just having the conversation in community, which inevitably comes up, even if you're not trying to, because they're asking, oh, what are you reading or what have you been working on? And if you're reading books about body care or grief, then they want to know more and they get fascinated and want to know what an end-of-life doula is. So walking that path and having those conversations keeps that channel open, and then the work will start coming to you. When somebody dies or when something happens, you're going to come to their mind as the person who will have an understanding of how to support you in a unique way. And that's how I got started with the hands-on work. And then I learn so much through every person I work with.
Yeah, I was going to say it has to be very, you know, specific to who you're counseling, right? And their background, their experiences. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind. I know, like I said, you know, every death is an individuation process unto itself. But if you wouldn't mind going through, like, what is kind of the schema, if like from the time you get the phone call to the time the work is done, what does that look like for, you know, maybe a generalized idea?
It's wildly different. So there's been a couple of times where I've gotten a phone call and it's somebody who has maybe taken one of my workshops or has had conversations with me who know their rights, and they have had their person suddenly die unexpectedly. They find a body and they've already called paramedics or whatever, but they've known from our conversations that they have the right to keep their person for longer than just getting them whisked away. So they'll call me in when there's like a body on the floor or like face down on the bed and they're like, I need help. What do I do? Help me with the situation. And so from that point, I'll help with the shock and grief processing, figuring out, making phone calls, setting that person up to be just viewed for a few hours or for the day before the removal technicians come in, to just so that initial shock isn't accompanied by the removal of their person. And it's just like that person is ripped away from them. There's a little bit more time to process and understand what's happening. And with those, I've moved on with grief support with those people and then helped with the memorials. My last client, she contacted me 2 years ago, the first time when she was diagnosed with cancer. We did some of her paperwork. She got a surgery. She was okay for a while and then contacted me again when it was back. And I spent a year and a half with her working through that. And she got a 6 to 12 month prognosis at that point and still lived for a year and a half. So I spent a lot of time with her working on her death plan and all of the things. And when it was progressing, I was there a couple of times a week working with her and her hospice nurse and figuring out what her needs were and getting those accommodated. Was there for her death, did a home funeral, was there for a witness placement aquamation with her. And then I just officiated her memorial a couple of days ago. So that was a very drawn out process versus coming in and there's a sudden death and they have to process it very quickly.
Right. That's the not for the bereaved. You were actually the transition guide for someone in that case. Mm-hmm. But you do straddle that line, you know, even at the same time for both. Right.
Right. And there was one client where I had an online consultation with this woman and her husband, and her husband was in the final stages of cancer. And then I met with them in person. And then it was the next day that he died. So I worked with them very intensely and very closely for a few days. So I was able to only meet him for his final day of life and then helped his wife with washing his body and doing a home funeral right after he died. And then that was all that they needed from me. So that was very intense, very hands-on for just like a 3-day period.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And you say, you know, washing your body, I know in like, you know, the Jewish religion and Islam, a lot of body washing practice still happens. So when you're like your processes, as if they were bare, say like the person was irreligious or, you know, secular or something, have you noticed a kind of like patchworking of different traditions and techniques that you're bringing in that you find is like a good kind of umbrella for, you know, this sort of work?
Yeah, absolutely. I support people doing ritual that is that's unique to them and authentic to who they are, and not necessarily of any denomination. So, and I want to specify that with the washing of the body, it is not legal for an end-of-life doula to charge to do something like that. I'm not the person that's washing the people's body. Right. And unless it's a case where it's like a person who I'm close with and that's what they wanted from me and that's not something I'm charging for. But I will support, like with this woman, I supported her in washing her husband's body. I held the water, suggested she put whatever oils that he loved. She crushed up dried flowers from their wedding bouquet. And these are the sort of ritual important things that she included into it that were not religious. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the washing of the body is necessary for the to stave off bacteria growth if you do want to keep the body at home for a few days. So you want to do a really thorough antibacterial washing. Or if it's just you're keeping the body for the day, it's not something that's hygienically necessary, but it feels really important to kind of wash away that pain, wash away that sweat and anxiety and those final things, and to just honor your person in that way. It feels really special, and it's not necessarily of any specific religious sect that is being right. coming into play.
Yeah, no, that's it just seems like such a beautiful somatic kind of, it's just very different from, you know, a stranger in a gown dealing with mm-hmm. the person you've loved, you know, your life.
Yeah. Like and having... so psychologically helpful to the grieving process.
Right. Yeah. And I could branch off in many number of ways, but the one thing I think that keeps coming up that we should talk about are like the legalities like involved mm-hmm. with this, because I think a lot of us are in the dark about what you are legally possible, or like what is legally possible for you to do, and also like, you know, surrounding that, even burial, like what, because I used to joke with friends, I was like, please dig a ditch, throw my naked body in, let me give back to the earth. And people were like, oh well, no, you know, it's not legal because it's contamination, or you know, I'm not sure, there's a myriad of different ways that the bureaucracy could come in and, you know, mess with that kind of wish. So, yeah, what are you finding most people aren't aware of legal-wise when it comes to this?
So it is legal to keep your person at home when they die. If they die suspiciously, unexpectedly, they are going to have to get taken to get examined. But you are allowed some time with them. They don't have to be taken right away. But if it's an expected death, if the person is on hospice, all you have to do is call the hospice worker, let them know the time of death, the person died, and then you can keep the body there. The legal wording is that they can be kept at home for 24 hours and then have to be refrigerated, which essentially just means on ice. And sure. So that's something that I can support families through as a home funeral guide, is how to keep ice under the body and keep the body cooled. And they can, then the law actually just says for as long as is reasonable. It doesn't even have a specific amount of days, but usually traditionally it's around 3 days for a lot of people, but it can vary from 1 to 3 from my experiences. So it is legal to keep your person at home. It's actually legal to transport them. The family can act as their own funeral director. You don't even have to go through a funeral home at all in the state of Washington. I find that it's helpful to do so just for permits and death certificates to make it easier on yourself so that you don't have to do all of that, those legality issues, because those could be a huge pain in the ass. But you can really be hands-on with your person. They die at home, you can keep them at home for a home funeral. You can transport them to their place of disposition. If you take them to a green burial ground, you can dig the grave, wrap them in a shroud, put them in, bury them yourself. There are these available options that people aren't necessarily aware of. The options for disposition in Washington state, it is not legal to bury somebody on your own property. In many other states, it is. I think that there might be some motions to change that, but you have to designate your land as a burial ground in order to do that, or as a graveyard. So there's things around that. However, there are several green burial grounds in the Washington state that are really beautiful. I've dug a grave over at Oconee Ranch at the White Eagle Memorial, which is kind of southeast from here. There's one called Herland National Forest. There's one in Bellingham called Moles in the Meadow. My friend Brian Flowers, who's a funeral director up in the Bellingham area, just opened his own green burial funeral home, and it's absolutely beautiful there.
And then there's other options such as natural organic reduction or human composting. And there's several facilities that have opened up in Washington for that. And it's becoming more widely legalized across the U.S. I was just at Return Home a few days ago giving a sound bath to the funeral directors there because I just adore them so much. They're really wonderful people. A good friend of mine is a funeral director at Recompose. And she actually has attended all of my classes and workshops and comes and volunteers at my weekend retreat every year. There's aquamation, which is an available option, which is water cremation that is more environmentally friendly than fire cremation.
Right.
People also don't realize that they have the option to do witness placement where they can be with their person's body as it's getting placed into a cremation chamber or an aquamation chamber or a terramation vessel. And they can potentially be the one to push the button to start the process.
Right. Yeah, no, that's beautiful. I was reading about aquamation the other day. And yeah, it's interesting that there does seem to be this kind of collective push to kind of be less, how do I put it? Like less tethered to kind of the modernity of the hospital kind of situationalism, I think, that we found ourselves in. So yeah, it's really beautiful. And I was wondering, what you just said, like there are sanctioned kind of, you know, yards or land that folks can do these things on. So yeah, that's really wonderful. One of the things that you were talking about too, like obviously this would all be a part of coordinating a death plan, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were working with somebody that, you know, is on the transition kind of mend or, you know, is going that route, what are some of like the main decisions that somebody would need, you know, to really source and figure out? Is it obviously how they want, you know, their remains to be? I hate saying that word remains. Also, if I say a word that isn't like, you know, copacetic to the kind of community, like, please let me know. I'd love to learn the lexicon. Yeah. But the recently dispatched, I would say, like, you know, what to, yeah, where they want to be, how they can do it. You know, you're giving them options on where and who. What are some other kind of major things in a death plan other than what to do?
Right. So there's kind of two forms of a death plan that I work with. And the first is advanced care directive. And that's the kind of legality. And that one is really important. I do a lot of workshops with that one because especially in alternative communities and LGBTQ communities and magical communities, we don't necessarily align with our blood family all of the time. And in alternate communities, we find ourselves estranged, unfortunately, from the family who would legally have custody over our body or be in charge of our healthcare decisions were we not able to ourselves. And there have been cases in the past where transgender individuals have been dead named and misgendered upon their death because estranged family swoops in and takes over, whereas their chosen family has absolutely no rights unless they've done this paperwork. So I help people through the process of naming, number one, who will be their healthcare advocate, who will be able to speak for them if they're in a coma, who will know their wishes and understand what they would want in those situations. But your healthcare advocate, their rights end when you die, and then it defaults back to blood family in a certain order. So it also, the form that I use through End of Life Washington also designates the person who will be in charge of your funeral plans or have custody of your body when you die. And that way you can be honored the way that you would want by the people who you love and who understand you. And it also gives an option of what your preferred death disposition method is. So that's the legal forms that I find that are really important to make sure that your wishes will be honored. And then I have a whole death plan that I elaborate with, of especially if somebody is planning to die at home, if they know that they have an affliction that will cause their death, then they can decide where they want to die. They want to die in their bedroom. They want to have a thing set up in their living room. They want to be in their backyard. Who do you want to have around you? Who don't you want to have around you? What smells do you want to smell? What music do you want to hear? Are you comfortable with somebody washing your body? If so, who? Are you comfortable with someone taking a lock of your hair? I really go into detail around what your wishes are around your death. Is it okay for people to take photographs of you following your death and when you're laying in honor? And that way there's not any questions by the people left behind and you're honored to the fullest. Another thing that I found that psychologically it's really helpful for is in a situation when you're dying, it feels like a huge loss of control. It's something that is happening to you and it feels really powerless. So to be able to bring back some control and power to a situation that feels so powerless, I've seen people just like lighten up and get excited about their death. And that feels
right.
Really good.
Yeah. I love that. You're empowering like this kind of intrinsic control that we all deserve, you know, during that time. But yeah, a lot of those things you would definitely not think of off the top of your head that are so important, because you're also weaving through the legalities of things and who does what and who can do what. Your advocacy, especially with this whole sect, has been like really inspirational. And I love hearing about, you know, I've read some testimonials of people that, you know, you've really helped that are probably from, you know, more of the marginalized communities, from, you know, from that faction. I had a question about like elder orphans, you know, folks that don't have anybody around them, folks that can't really answer those questions because there's no one to put a name down. Like, what are some options that elder orphans have in this work?
That one's really challenging because it can be a large spectrum of their situations as well. In those cases, sometimes social workers can step in and work with them as far as being their advocates. And if they wanted to work with a doula as well, there's a lot of doulas who do volunteer and pro bono work who would sit with them bedside if they needed that and help to have their wishes carried out. I also volunteer at Bailey Boucher House once a week. I've been volunteer there for 6 years. And that is such an amazingly special place because the residents and outpatients who are there are people in marginalized communities who are stigmatized, who are othered, and they are taken care of so well. And they're often adult orphans, but they have been collected into this community and tended to, and their deaths are really honored.
I love that. It's is there some sort of kind of, I know it just seems like it's such a niche, but it doesn't have to be, you know, it's kind of frustrating that it's a niche. Mm-hmm. Are there kind of programs for like scholarships or, you know, to pay for these services for, you know, the less fortunate or like, are there, yeah.
I mean, there should be more. I have a Patreon that people can sign up for or just donate to that gets forwarded directly to services that I do, sliding scale or pro bono for people. And a lot of my students who I work with, they're always looking for opportunities to gain experience. So they would be, if I knew somebody who needed some support, then I could contact one of my students and see if they wanted to support that person. It can be a little challenging regarding boundaries if you're offering support free of charge, because some people can really take advantage of that or push those boundaries in interesting ways. So it is kind of a delicate balance, and you want to be intentional about who you do work with and when you offer that.
Yeah. So I put in the chat because, you know, I keep asking about, you know, resources. Bree is a resource, very much so. And especially with your work with Melissa Gonzalez and Stone Circles Collective, can you talk about the collective? Can you talk about how you guys came together and what Stone Circles is?
Absolutely. So it was around 5 years ago. I knew that I wanted to be an end-of-life doula, and that was I was going on this path. But I also knew how important community is within the death worker community, that we can support each other, that if we have a client or a situation where somebody needs to sit bedside during a death, so that we can kind of trade hands with somebody we trust who has their values aligned with ours. So it was initially put together with a good friend of mine who's a psychiatric nurse who goes by Vi. And there were a couple other people in the collective initially. And we went through some ideas. We were going to start a nonprofit. I realized pretty early on that it would be most beneficial to my momentum to just have my very own business and have everybody who I work with have their own businesses. That way we can move at our own pace and nobody's holding each other back or feeling frustrated at different ways of running a business. So a few of the people in the collective, one of them moved away, decided to pursue Chinese medicine. Another one left to pursue their business. It's because being an end-of-life doula is not necessarily a sustainable career in a lot of ways. Sure. It's a more of a labor of love. So if it's not something that you have the time or emotional energy for, that's something that you figure out fairly quickly. But it was around a few years ago that I knew Melissa as a person. She's absolutely wonderful gem of a human, just so kind and warm natured. And I think social media, I saw that she was also studying at end of life doula work, which I didn't know about her. And I reached out and had some phone conversations and invited her into the collective. And we've been working together ever since. And it's been really lovely. We do monthly sound healing Reiki sessions together for groups. We teach the retreat together. Vi is still involved as well. They don't necessarily do end of life doula work, but they're involved in community advocacy and in teaching and have always been a part of it. And is a very dear friend of mine. And they're the one who's listed on my advanced care directive to advocate for me were I to need it.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. I wanted to share the retreat that you've mentioned a couple of times that's actually happening this month. Mm-hmm. There's a video on the page and I'll share the link when we do this, but I thought we could share the visuals of the video and you can kind of talk about what's happening in this retreat, because it seems like it perfectly encapsulates kind of stone circles, the kind of collective work, and then also an introductory, you know, kind of what do the kids say? A vibe check, you know, on the, on the whole thing. So so this is where do the retreats usually happen?
It happens on this really beautiful foresty land in Payel, which is near Chehalis. My friend Amber owns 32 acres of land, which also hosts the Cascadian Midsummer Festival that just happened. And it's just moss and ferns and cedars and a creek running through it. It's absolutely gorgeous. I've spent a lot of really special time on that land for over a decade. And so I rent the land from her to do this retreat every year. And what it is, it's a death doula training retreat that's a lot of hands-on. It's the kind of instruction that I craved when I was initially learning. And so there's a few classes online that lead up to it so that we have plenty of space to move through the work once we're there and that there's space to spend time with the land and such. But once we're there, we build a large ancestral altar. We have discussions and ritual around the fire. We do hands-on training on body care, how to turn bodies, how to change the ice, how to shroud, how to wash the body so that people can really practice with a body on a massage table, which is the best way to get your skills in that work and to be able to support families that you're helping to do that work as well. And this type of thing really does work. I've turned a body that was like over 6 foot, 330-pound man, and just like using those skills, it's not challenging with some help to turn their body and help their people wash them. And then collectively, we dig a grave together. And just even when we first dig it, even though it's not part of the curriculum, nobody can resist lying in the fresh earth. It feels so good and it feels so powerful. We then will dress the grave together with ferns and flowers and moss. And we have a ritual where everybody gets a chance to be shrouded in that grave when everybody is singing around them, throwing handfuls of dirt. It's this meditation on your own mortality that is really profound and transformative.
I was going to say the kind of, there's no better way to be immersive in, you know, this kind of care-to-care passion. I mean, because literally this is the rarity of being a death doula is being a guide to something you haven't experienced yet. but are familiar with, you know. So yeah, I love the idea of, you know, you do as much as you can to kind of breathe the atmosphere or the mindset of what somebody during the transition might be, you know, considering and thinking and feeling and ruminating on. So
Yeah. And this type of ceremony is really something that's available to you when you die. Like, if you really wanted to, you could have your body shrouded directly into the earth. And just the act of dressing the grave, like you see there, is it's so beautiful. Yeah, it's a really profound experience. And then we make time to process any grief or anything that came up from that later on. We'll carry the body on a body board to the grave. Yeah. Like, I think that we were the first year we were doing this, we were found it very humorous that we were death LARPing, as we called it.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
I love that. And then the reveal. The shroud. So I love, because, you know, when I was asking earlier, like, what are some of the, like, maybe the generalized schema, you know, of what you're doing, it looks like you really go through, you know, the entire process as it would be, right? Mm-hmm. But of course, you're going to use the resonance of people's, you know, cultural beliefs and stuff, correct?
Absolutely. Like, yeah, you meet them where they're at. I don't ever pretend to understand exactly a person's religion or culture without talking to them. I'll educate myself on traditionally what a religion or culture does so that I have some awareness, but don't ever assume that that's what they're doing. I may ask about it out of a place of curiosity of like, oh, I know that you're of the Jewish faith. I'm curious, or is covering a mirror, the mirror is part of something that you do in these death situations. And sometimes they'll be like, oh no, I don't do that. Or, oh yeah, that is something that we do. I'm going to go ahead and do that now. But coming at it as a place of, from curiosity rather than, oh, well, shouldn't you be doing this since you're Jewish? That's presumptuous and insulting. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And you had mentioned, you know, when you were getting into this sect that you had the constitution for it, right? Mm-hmm. There was a kind of ingrown, you know, ability to be present and to be listening, and to maybe not be overtly emotional or allow the emotions to kind of overtake, even though I'm sure they're still there. Is there, like, have you found it's easier to be of a more kind of, you know, academic materialist kind of practitioner during these things, to kind of separate yourself outside of like the more deeply metaphysical resonances, or, you know, the kind of emotional stuff? Is that more of a decorum that people should have when doing
that? That's what works for me. And it's a very hard rule that I teach my students, that the family should never be supporting you. They should never be comforting you. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to break down. It's okay to feel these things. But find your person to support you that is not involved. So if you need support, that's okay. I also tell my students, like, because some people go into this work like, oh, I'm an empath, I should be doing this. Put your empath in check. If you walk into a room full of grief and anger and you absorb all of that, this is probably not the right work for you. I can move into a space with really strong energetic boundaries. And even if it's somebody who I know and I love, I can stave that off to be the main support and put on my doula hat and do what needs to be done and organize everything, and then have my feelings on my own time, take my spirit bath with my herbs and just kind of wash it away and feel what's appropriate when it's appropriate.
Right. As somebody that has witnessed, you know, that transition, like, firsthand, is probably as often as you have, how has it informed your kind of ontology of like what life is, maybe what, you know, of an afterlife, of, you know, how is it kind of parlayed into maybe what you had already thought and has been revealed in sort of a way, or, you know, how is that meshing?
I still don't have any firm belief of what exactly happens in the afterlife, because we can't know. Right. I have had a lot of experiences with psychopomp beings in my time doing this work and prior to this, which is something that I've paid the most attention to. Even when I was walking to the space where I was facilitating the memorial the other day, a dragonfly, the same color as my person's shroud, came up to me and led me to the space. And she also really loved dragonflies. So that was, that felt really special and profound. I've also, yeah, I've had a lot of experiences with psychopomp beings. And that's one of the classes that I teach, is I'll do a guided meditation sound bath journey to delve deep and explore who the psychopomp spirits are that work with you. And then I go into a lecture about folklore and history with psychopomps.
See, I love that. Yeah, that's absolutely beautiful. And also, you know, this idea, like maybe we can talk a little bit about psychopomps, maybe specifically for folks that don't know the term.
Right.
How would you kind of generalize what a psychopomp is?
A psychopomp is a guide of souls from the land of the living to the realm of the dead. Mm-hmm. So it can take the form, I think the most famous example is the Grim Reaper. They come and collect you upon death. There are so many different psychopomp spirits, beings, deities throughout culture and history. Mm-hmm. Or you think of the ferryman, Charon, like going over the river Styx. You think about, like, in Christianity, there's Michael the Archangel. The song Michael Row Your Boat Ashore is about him rowing the spirits from the land of the living to the land of the dead over the river Styx, which I think is really fascinating. Or bringing them to the river. I don't know if it's the same one. There's a lot of similarities in that culture. Things like crows, the movie The Crow, the crow brings him back from the dead and escorts his spirit out to the land of the living. It's kind of a going back and forth, and it helps spirits to visit the land of the living following their death, or for even like ancestors to come check in on you when you're going through a strange liminal space, because I've had that experience as well.
Yeah. So, and then I love this, is that, you know, there's these kind of synchronous, the like symbology is breathing. It's kind of bleeding for you, you know, in the tail of the dragonfly. Like there is kind of an overarching, what I love about like your sect of work and it being kind of more of a collaborative kind of, you know, folkloric affair. It's not, you know, delineated to, you know, Egyptian lore or whatever, that there is a beautiful kind of imaginarium where all of these psychopomps exist, you know, it could be Coyote, it could be Vishnu, it could be, you know what I mean? Like these all kind of interact. I do find it funny. I do feed the crows here on Beacon Hill. Got a few of their friends, and I actually held a funeral for one of them. A couple, I guess it was maybe 6 months ago, but yeah, it was maybe unwittingly or wittingly so, always kind of giving service to these archetypes, right? And the psychopomp is such a perfect analogous like archetype for the work that you're doing. And I just, yeah, I find that super fascinating. It's a really beautiful like servitude that, you know, these kind of exist with.
Yeah, and it helps to feel connected with the afterlife and with your people just by noticing these signs and symbols and having that sense of feeling something profound. It's circling back to when I did my senior seminar project around psychology, around grief and ritual, having those connecting pieces, especially in a time where a lot of people are cremated or their disposition is such that there's not a physical place to go visit their body. And you can't just like walk to a grave and go have that moment with that person. You have to find it in the world. You have to go sit under a tree that was your favorite tree in a place that you went together. Or every time you see a dragonfly, you think of that person. It's a way to connect with them for that psychological healing and grief processing and remembrance.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But of course, like, you know, thing for me, obviously in the, you know, the compound or the confluence, I should say, of like pragmatism and magic, right? Not to use it overtly, but that kind of confluence between more of like the somatic and the metaphysical. I think that your work, especially having the background in psychology and you're leaning towards, and I love that you put on the kind of materialist or just like very, how do I put it? It's, I hate to use the word materialist. It's not what I mean, but a very like kind of matter of fact resonance during this work, but yet you still do have very much, you know, a wide eyed view of kind of the big unanswerables. Right.
And yeah, I think that there's a very, profound connection between science, psychology, and magic. Mm-hmm. If you think about manifestation, that's magic and its psychology, the act of performing certain rituals, psychologically prime you to have those come to pass. It's all intertwined.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask, because of that confluence, so, and how it kind of radiates through everything, I'm sure for you as well as it does me, and especially when it comes to art, right? Which there's no simpler explanation of magic than there is, you know, the creation of art. And you are also a musician, mm-hmm. and an amazing one at that.
Thank you.
We were talking earlier about you have a kind of a dark wave project called mm-hmm. Other, mm-hmm. Which is, yeah, really cool. But you also, you know, perform with a group that's a kind of, how do I put it? It's like kind of, I think you guys describe it as like a dark polka or like death like polka.
Depressing
or,
polka.
Which is great. I love that stuff. And we were talking earlier how we both play musical saw, mm-hmm. Which I haven't in a long time. But how have you, has art been more of a inspirational totem, or has it been kind of an exhaust pipe, you know, for all of these heavy works that you do within, you know, being the death doula? Are you able to kind of parlay those deep feelings and resonances like easier through the act of music, or is it just something that's just kind of obvious and it has to be done, that's ingrained in you, you know?
Music is therapy, absolutely, and it really does help me to channel a lot of things that I've experienced and that I go through. I write a lot of songs about death. So my first band, Witch Bottle, I wrote a song that's called Bury My Heart that's about death rituals throughout the world, that's like kind of incorporated into this love song. There's another single that I'll be releasing for Other soon. I just haven't done it yet. It's called Hereafter, and that's one that's it's kind of a nod to that famous poem of like, do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not here. I do not sleep. But it's more of my style of when I'm dead, I'm not going to be at my grave. I'm going to be in the forest. You're going to find me in the trees and in the fire and in the wind and in the rain. And so that's my song about that. My newest one that I'm almost done with is about the most recent death that I helped with and wrapping her in her shroud and the experience of watching her suffering and her transition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I channel a lot of it in my art.
Yeah. I know that's beautiful. I feel like, you know, but also the art was always something that was there for you. It's just kind of a nice Ouroboros of, you know, kind of cause and effect of the creation of art, but also living the art. Right. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just wondered how, you know, through your work, if it's like really deeply informed your art, and it has, obviously, as you just said, like very much so. Mm-hmm. It's you're even kind of regaling it to your own lore and your own, you know, history and tales. And yeah, I find that all fascinating. And I love that you have the spectrum, you know, from the depressing polka to the dark wave kind of stuff. You know, I'm a big fan of both those kind of sects, and you know, it's bridging that somatic, you know, kind of busking with the kind of cold kind of isolation, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just really cool. I always love seeing folks that live their art, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There was a question from Sharon. Do you make sense of meditating, imagining a space between death and birth without thinking there is life after death? I had a class with a death doula related to yoga, and we did that. So yeah, basically, I guess just kind of haunting the liminal, right? The threshold. maybe not so much what's behind the threshold, but
there. Meditating a space between death and birth. So that would just be life, right?
Yeah. So I guess like after death and before birth, right? In the circle, it's like,
oh, got it. Got it. Got it. So that liminal space.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. And it's one of those things where I'm still not completely certain what my thoughts are around reincarnation. So that is an interesting thought. I am preparing a death meditation that will be kind of meditating around your own death, and then maybe something would come to you what that liminal space is that would be conjured up in your own spirit. So I've also studied hypnotherapy, and I use that a lot with people with anxiety, with grief processing. So I have a sound healing business as well. I have an office in the Capitol Hill area where I use a large, like, 32-inch gong and large crystal singing bowls to either just do sound bath sessions, or I incorporate that with an induction and guided journey, which is essentially synonymous with hypnotherapy, to address grief and trauma and work through certain things.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I love, you know, to use the word again, confluence, but like that bridging of, you know, the death doula work and your sound bath stuff. It reminds me of the Bardo's Thodol and, you know, hearing through the Bardo's. Have you used the therapy like during an actual transition, or is it more kind of like a preliminary rite sort of a thing, or a soothing, you know, centering sort of a thing?
I haven't yet used it during an actual transition, but I have given sound baths to the dying. I've given a sound bath at a funeral home with a woman laying on the floor next to the vessel that her mother was in. It's to help her with her processing and reclaiming of energy, because that was a complicated situation. And there are some really incredible funeral homes in the Seattle and broader areas that are willing to accommodate that kind of ritual, which is not usual. I'll use sound therapy. I have something called a Shruti box, which is like a drone instrument. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I'll play that during sacred times, like when somebody's washing their person, I'll keep that drone going to keep that kind of sound therapy happening during. Yeah. It brings an ambiance to the atmosphere that is supportive of that.
Have you studied like psychoacoustics? I know, like, in your kind of bridging of psychology and everything, have you studied kind of the science of, you know, sound's effect on consciousness, or, you know, mental stuff, and that's why you kind of lean towards it? Or was this more of a natural kind of instinctual, you know, helping sort of thing?
It was more instinctual and intuitive that this felt supportive in the work that I do. And I also did research on it after I started doing it to kind of further validate the methods that I was using. And sound vibrational healing really does help to alter brain waves. If somebody has a lot of anxiety or a lot of grief and they're just kind of like up here in fight or flight mode, it can help to shift the brain waves to a more relaxed state. And it's been proven to lower blood pressure, help with sleep, help reduce anxiety, help with depression, those sort of things. So that, in combination with the hypnotherapy and kind of going through a story of metaphor to address things that have been really challenging, it can help people through those processes. Or if somebody has a trauma around a certain place, I've helped to reframe the imagery that comes to mind in that place with something that is more beautiful or helpful, and just reframe the consciousness around places or ideas.
Yeah, that was my question on the subject of hypnotherapy. Like, you know, is it a cognitive reframing that you're doing, or is it more of like a elimination, you know? But it sounds like, yeah, no, there's still a communion with the stuff. It's just walk me through that process of like hypnotherapy. I mean, obviously you can't, you know, do the whole thing, but like, what is the process like, especially when it comes to utilizing it? Do you utilize it within the end of life stuff?
if that's what they want. I have all of these tools available for whoever is drawn to using them. So with hypnotherapy, maybe one example is a specific journey that I do is I'll with each of them, I'll start with an induction where I'll be on the bowls and the gong. We'll do box breathing exercises, biologically calm the system. I'll do a kind of a body scan, relax every part, kind of get them into a induct them into a trance-like state. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I just take them on guided visualization. If you try to address trauma head on with somebody, even in a meditative state, it can cause their defense mechanisms to just shut that door and be like, oh, think about the time that this really bad thing happened to you. They're going to be like, nope, not thinking about that. That's what I'm avoiding. But if one of the journeys that I do, which is like, can be a several part journey where we like go in and do a lot more work with it, is like bringing them into the house that represents them. But even along the way, it's like feeling the air, noticing what's around you, hearing the insects buzz around, and it really kind of transports you into that space and you feel safe and you feel comfortable. Going into a home, having your main altar there, noticing what's there, and then going into a room that represents your body. What do you see and what needs work? What kind of items are there? Going into a room that reflects your spirit and going into a room that's your grief room. It's like, if you have a comfortable place to sit. Is it dusty? Is it cold? Does it need tending to? Or are you, is it a place that you feel comfortable? And people come out of these hypnotic inductions really surprised by what they found. You're like, I found this weird thing in the room of my body and I need to think about that and where's that coming from? And then maybe the next session we'll go in and we'll repair what's broken, or like we'll get a hammer and nails and like fix the thing, or we'll add some plants or whatever it is that feels like it needs to be tended to. But often it's like this subconscious, these subconscious signals and messages that they get that they didn't really realize that they were there, that we open the doors to, so that they have a better understanding of where they're at in these specific things, or where they're at in their grief, and how their mind can tend to it in a way that supports their healing.
It sounds useful to anyone who's still like not in that susceptible range. Like, it would just be a beautiful meditation, even if they couldn't really get to that place, just that kind of processing of it. Mm-hmm. Do you find that there's a lot of roadblocks with the hypnotherapy and certain people, or is this more of kind of a, you know, it, given the elements, it would work no matter what?
It varies with different people. Some are more inclined to benefit from this sort of thing than others. Like, there's no one method of therapy that's going to work for everybody, and that's okay. Usually, regardless of success of their visualizations or what they found, I've seen that everyone who I've worked with has come out of it feeling relaxed, feeling refreshed. They look like they've just had the most like comfortable nap, and they're ready to like go about their day in a more grounded, peaceful way.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So that's beneficial regardless.
This is an interesting question. Is it advisable to avoid mixing sound therapy with aromatherapy? Maybe to not mix hypersense focused things? I don't know.
I think that they have a beautiful union together, and they should only be avoided if somebody has specific associations with certain scents that are not helpful. Like, maybe there was an abusive person who always wore lavender, and there's that association there. So understanding your client's needs and seeing where they might have challenges around certain scents could be helpful. But one thing that I like to do is put a grounding oil on my wrists. So when I'm finished with the hypnotherapy session, I go in with a tuning fork for grounding, and my hands are over their face, and then they have that scent of grounding to bring them back as well.
That's amazing. Yeah, I was thinking of that too, because a lot of times I know in the super highway to memory are like these hauntological artifacts that are triggered a lot because of smell, right? A lot of times you forget and they just kind of happen. So maybe, you know, it's kind of better to not have the variables there just in case, unless you, as you were saying, like really checked in or like, you know, talked about that. So yeah, it's all kind of very specific, I guess, to the client, as most of this stuff is. You know, I do want to ask though, and maybe this kind of a general, you know, resource for folks, are there any texts or books that have helped you maybe refortify your constitution when it comes to dealing with grief and loss, or even, you know, helping service people transition?
I'm always looking for and reading books about this subject. And there's some really cool ones. Stephen Jenkinson is a really incredible being who wrote this book called Die Wise. And it's this, it's a thick, substantial book, but it's got a really, a lot of really powerful information and insights and philosophies around death and dying. There's also a documentary about him called Grief Walker. So that's one that I would suggest. One of my most recent favorites is one by a psychologist called Unfuck Your Grief. And it's humorous. It's based in a lot of science and psychology, and it's just like really accessible to anybody, even if they don't have a science background, to kind of understand the grief process and how to help that. There's different books around ritual and death and dying. Death Nesting was another one that I really enjoyed. I'm sure there's so, I mean, there's, I have a broad collection of death and grief books. And usually at my retreat, I'll set up like a little library outside with all of my books for people to browse through and spend some time reading in the woods.
Yeah, that's lovely. And also, I forgot to say, I think it was actually Melissa was in here and mentioned that there is one spot left.
Yeah, there's actually two spots left because signed up, but then they backed out. So there's two spots left in our retreat, and it's going to be July 19th through the 21st. It's a really profound, amazing experience. Everyone comes out of it.
And I mean, so yeah, it's kismet. Of course, it's happening so quickly, but yeah, it's definitely on the forefront of my mind to attempt to do this. At least, is it yearly or is there one kind of close after?
It's yearly. It's annual. Okay. So this will be our third annual one.
Nice. Yeah. I'd hate to miss it. I hope that, of course, like how things aligned, you know, it's been kind of a whirlwind of, you know, so interested in all of this. And of course the event's happening in a couple of weeks, you know.
Yeah, maybe you got to just jump on it.
I think so. Yeah. But as I work with that in the background, I wish I had a show producer that could, you know, Google the Stephen Jenkins books and stuff and put those in links, but I will put those, when we do the podcast form of this, Grief Town and, Die Wise. And, there was another book you had mentioned, Unfuck Your Grief, which I think is going to sing for a lot of people. I think not only is it maybe the taboo nature, the kind of, you know, cheeky, you know, interest that folks have about death, but I am seeing kind of a huge, you know, resurgence about like truly communing with it in ways. And I'm always wanting to understand, like, yeah, like if people were interested in kind of doing this work, like, you know, what they would facilitate for themselves. And it sounds like from your experience, even though it's like very specific and personal, a lot of it is like understanding the legalities too of the state of which you work in.
Absolutely. You know, like being an advocate is huge in this type of work. Because a lot of even funeral professionals or police, they don't even know the laws, and being able to advocate for that. Like I've said, I've shown up at a place where there was a death. It was one of those sudden deaths that I was called into, and there was a policeman waiting outside, and he's just like, "Oh, you're the death doula. We need information about where the body's going so I can tell the coroner and this and that." And just like, "I'm not giving that to you right now. We have lots of time. Go ahead and give me your card. You could leave. I'll let you know later." And he was relieved. He's like, "Okay, you're on top of it. It's fine. I can go now." There was an instance recently at a facility where we were doing a witness aquamation, and the the funeral director met with me outside, and she's like, they say that we can't put the shroud material through the machine, and that she has to go in naked, maybe covered with a compostable plastic bag. I'm like, no, her family's here to watch her go through. I got that shroud material specifically because it can go through that machine. I put that material through that machine before, and you're going to come with me and we're going to go talk to him. And I went back there and I pretty much told the aquamation facility director how to do his job, and got my way, got to reshroud her and put her through. But if I didn't have the strength in my convictions and the knowledge to advocate in that way, then it would make the situation different or more challenging for the family.
Right. And it's like such a fine line you have to, you know, kind of weave in, because there is no credentialing system, and there really shouldn't be. But there isn't any sort of, you know, brisk piece of paper that bureaucrats would look at and be like, oh, okay, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, you really do have to, you know, understand, yeah, these legalities, and what to, you know, enforce for the good of whoever, you know, you're helping transition, or their family, the grieving and stuff. So,
yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah. And like, it's such important work for the advocacy part of that too. And, I know that you also, and I'll keep saying this, you know, we keep bringing up like resources. Bree is a resource. And if you go to Stone Circles, you do list the many different kind of avenues folks could not only reach out to you, but also, you know, take one-on-one kind of mentorships and all sorts of things. So do you mind just talking a little bit about like, yeah, what you kind of offer, like the array of which you offer?
So personally, I offer like mini mentorships, or on my Patreon, I have like a mentorship package where you get certain amount of sessions from me, energetic hygiene sound baths, discounts on my classes. The classes that I offer beyond the retreat are, I have a 2-part ritual support in death, dying, and grief workshop. Each part is about 4 hours. It's online. My next being in September, and I've been teaching that one for a few years, and I really love that one. I've had funeral directors, hospice workers, or just people wanting to further their community skills take that class, and it's really how to support people, meet them where they're at in various different ways through ritual, whether it be sitting bedside with the dying, or helping somebody when they're cleaning up their deceased mother's clothes and things, and how to the weight around throwing things away or saying goodbye to a space, and how to support people through that. So that's a class that I offer. I also have my Psychopomp Journey workshop that is in person. I'm developing a curriculum for a graveyard folklore workshop where we'll be making little protective talismans a funerary workshop. So I'm developing curriculum for more classes that will be in person and have hands-on fun things to do, because I really do love teaching, and I like having online and in-person options. My mini mentorship sessions, like I mentioned, usually if you just do a one-off, it's an hour where we sit together and we talk about what your skills are. We talk about what the options are. Some people want to get into the work, but they don't want anything to do with paperwork at all. Some people love the paperwork or legality aspect. Some don't want to have anything to do with bodies and just wanted like help with grief processing. So figuring out where on the spectrum they fall and how to further their education and path in that direction.
Yeah, very cool. I love it. You have like such a wealth of resources for folks looking to either to get into this or to actually be more acquainted, you know, with this process of the inevitable. Oswald, just we'll wind up here, but I know Oswald was itching to ask you about Hecate, as he's particularly interested given the death topic. I think we touched a bit about that in the psychopomp
Hecate is absolutely excellent psychopomp, wonderful goddess of death, so much symbology in her folklore and history. I absolutely love Hecate as someone to study and look into if you're interested in realms and folklore around death.
Yeah, goddess of the threshold.
Goddess of the underworld. She was a psychopomp who guided Persephone to and from the underworld.
Yeah, and we were just talking earlier about the you know, the yoga and that liminal space in between. She is really a goddess of the liminal.
Truly.
Yeah. So, yeah, so many confluences. I know that Oswald was bringing it to like some, you know, modern discourse about, you know, ancient Greek and all of that. It's truly fascinating. I think, you know, everybody is kind of coming. Anybody who's relegated in these sects are already going to be very invested and parlay, you know, deep individuation within ponderances of death. But I think you have provided us with tons of practical and like really pragmatic like aspects of it. And I'm really looking forward. Like I said, I'm slightly threatening to take that last spot. I've got to check in on stuff, but yeah, it's so good to know you. And it's been absolutely kismet that you're a neighbor too, which is funny.
Yeah.
And yeah, we got to do this in person sometime because I'd love to be more somatic about any of this stuff. You know, it's hard to exist on the internet spectrum. And since you do in-person workshops and all of that stuff too, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a feeling we'll see each other again.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, was that a threat? No, I'm just kidding.
That was a threat. And a promise.
But yeah, thank you again, Bree. And thank you to everybody who's in the chat and joined us. This is a very awesome turnout. I see 56 people watching across the platform. So thank you very much. Again, please visit StoneCirclesCollective.org. I put the link in the chat. Check out, you know, all of the show notes. When the podcast comes out, I will absolutely add all of the references and books that she mentioned. And as always, you know, haunt on.
Yeah. If you can't make it to my retreat, all of you, sign up for my ritual support class in September. There's a lot of it.
September's the next one. That's the big one. That's the psychopomp one, right?
No, that's the ritual support in death, dying, and grief. I don't have a new date for the psychopomp one yet, but it'll probably be around then too, or October. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. And what a perfect time in September as the autumnal swing rolls in. Well, thank you again, Bree, and thank you everybody watching. On top.
You can understand what I mean by profound if you'll think about how such knowledge, not belief, hope, faith, would affect your life. That you are indeed more than your physical body. That you do indeed survive physical death. Think about just knowing that. Just those two, as no one, absolutely, no conditions or complication. Story has it that as we go through life, we really don't change. We just become more of the same.
I am the ghost that hangs around. Yeah.
shapeless. Then as it warms up, it becomes soft around the edges. And finally, it becomes a liquid or a glob, or, say, a more convenient form, such as a teardrop, which is my favorite. Of course, you can reconstitute yourself back into your physical human shape just by thinking about it. The second body is extremely plastic. You can make it into any shape you want. You can stretch it like an incredible rubber band, release it, and snap back into a central mass.